David, you chose to visit a single square meter of forest every day for a year and write about it. Where did you get the idea?
The idea came from two different directions. One is I have a personal meditation practice that has taught me over the years the utility of focusing in on one little breath or one image. And the paradox is the more you focus in, the more you see. And so I wanted to apply that in an ecological sense to find out what I could learn from the forest by going to the forest and watching one small area as a lens into the whole. The other motivation was it provided a really interesting way of structuring a set of stories that were aimed to tell the stories of the forest, to communicate this all the amazing science that's been learned about forests in the last few decades.
Mm. It's kind of the scientist version of Blake's admonition to see the universe in a grain of sand.
Exactly, and heaven in a wild flower. And it's not just Blake. In many religious traditions, the idea of focusing and deliberately having the discipline to draw one's attention down and repeatedly return to the same place as an insight into bigger things. That this book is not about religion, but it draws on some of those insights.
This isn't entirely new to you, is it? I mean, you are a scientist, and observation of a natural occurrence would be a part of what you do always, but it's maybe more focused, more concentrated?
Yeah, I think it's more focused, more concentrated. Also, there was no agenda when I went into the woods, and that was a strong personal motivation. As a scientist, I go to the woods with a hypothesis, a set of data that I need to collect. So my observations are filtered through a set of pre-expectations and, frankly, of desires that I want to publish this paper and to understand this particular process. This year, watching one square meter, I deliberately stepped back from those expectations and said, I'm just going to go there with my unaided senses and see what happens. And be open to nothing happening or be open to observing things and paying attention to things that I previously would not have given my attention to. So there was an openness in this particular project that was not present in my work as a scientist or as a teacher where I go to the woods with a lesson plan.
So how did you choose this square meter of land?
That's an excellent question. I chose the square meter by walking through the woods until I found a rock on which I thought I could sit comfortably for a year. And the area in front of that rock became the focal area for the observation. It was a place I'd never seen before. I had no idea of its potential as a place for salamanders or wildflowers or anything else. And that openness to serendipity it runs through the book and was part of the selection of the place. I didn't have a spreadsheet categorizing all of strengths and weaknesses of thousands of square meters. I just picked one, stuck with it, and saw where that would take me.
So it wasn't a spot where you knew fascinating things were going to happen, and yet in some part of your mind you must have known that made it a greater challenge to find the fascinating things that actually were happening, whether you expected them or not.
Exactly. And I think one of the things I took away from this year was that we find wonder in the world by giving the world our attention, not by running around the world to find the most wonderful place, but to look at our homes, to look at the places where we are in a new light, and that light is the light of our focused concentration. And by doing that, whether it's at a square meter of forest or a particular trail through an urban neighborhood or a tree in a park, as we focus in, we see more and more, and the riches unfold in front of us. That was my hope in doing this, and that hope was fulfilled many, many times over. I was continually astounded at how much was happening in just this one square meter, let alone in the whole rest of the mountainside on which I was sitting.
So tell me about that day when you found the spot. You found a rock you could sit on comfortably, more or less, for a year, and you saw in front of you a square meter of forest floor. What was there? What did you see that day?
The square meter is ringed by a series of tumbled sandstone boulders that have rolled down from the cliff that sits at the top of the mountain slope. And those boulders are covered with dozens of species of lichens and mosses. So the first thing I observed just visually was the richness of the colors of the rocks. And then within that circle of rocks is a sort of fairly deep layer of leaf litter with, depending on the season, various creatures scurrying around. I began this observation in the middle of winter, but even then, it turned out that New Year's Day was a day with a thaw. Even then, there were quite extraordinary creatures. There was a nematomorph, which is also known as a Gordian worm, which is a little parasitic worm lying right at the center of the 1 square meter. It turns out this worm had escaped from the body of a cricket weeks before and was looking for a mate. So on a fairly dull day in January, just by focusing my visual senses on the forest, many different creatures popped into my consciousness.
And that Gordian worm has to have been something you would not have noticed if you hadn't stopped and looked right at that spot with intent.
Absolutely. And in fact, even stopping and looking at it, it took me quite a while to see this thing. It's quite well camouflaged. It looks like a tendril of a vine that had fallen onto the forest floor. And even staring at it, I didn't see. It was this motion. It has a peculiar writhing motion that gave it away to me. So even when we're giving something our attention, we're still blind to many of the things that are happening. And through the year, what I tried to do was just open my senses more and more, my visual sense, my sense of the acoustics of the forest, the smell of the world, and what that tells us about the lives, the hidden lives of microbes in the soil.
I'm curious about the acoustic. I mean, obviously, I work in radio, so I care about sounds. But what sounds did you hear, do you hear, in that spot, in your square meter of the world?
The expansion of my acoustic sense was one of the more unexpected outcomes of this year's watch in the forest. My PhD thesis was on bioacoustics. I made sound recordings of birds out in the woods, and so I'm quite well attuned to the acoustic nature of the world, to soundscapes. And yet I had not realized, until I'd really paid attention, the extent to which all the animals in the forest are listening to one another and are tied together in an acoustic network. It's sort of like Facebook, except run through the animals' ears. and they're always on Facebook. And that realization came to me when I startled the deer. I was sitting so still that the deer walked right up to me and almost collided with me before it ran away, making an alarm snorting sound. And as it left, I heard the chipmunks pick up the alarm, and then the squirrels in the trees, and then down the slope a wood thrush started alarm calling. And a wave of alarm spread out through the forest, and it took an hour for that wave to die down. So from then on, I realized how much the animals were eavesdropping on one another, and I could tell when a human was going to be arriving on a trail down the slope minutes before the person got there, because a bow wave of alarm calls would precede the movement of this person through the forest. That acoustic network, that social network of listening and calling, was something I knew about in the abstract but had never fully experienced. So now when I walk in the woods, I really try and sort of get beyond the voices in my head, if you like, and really pay attention to the sounds in the world.
The other thing about what you just said is how still you managed to be in the neighborhood of your little piece of land, because there's a couple of other sections of the book that I recall. One, when you got so close to a snail with a magnifying glass that you could actually watch it breathe almost, and later talking about a moth landing on your arm, I think.
Yes.
That's a skill that most of us don't have, to be that still for that long in one place.
Yeah, I think being quiet is a key that will unlock a lot of observations out in nature. And it's not just naturalists; it's not just me who found this out. Hunters know this. people who've gone out over hundreds of years, thousands of years to try and experience nature have found that just shutting up for a little while is a good thing. And for me as a professor, it's also a good thing since I make my living by wagging my tongue around. The part of our inheritance as primates is that we're very loud and noisy. If you've been around wild monkeys in tropical areas, they're always chattering to one another and squabbling. So I don't think it's just a product of modernity. I think this is who we are as a species, and it does take a deliberate act of the will to quiet that down, stop jiggling around, stop talking, and just listen for a while. And if we do that, we can sink into some of these quieter networks and see how the creatures are connected one to another. And for example, with the snail, getting up close requires not just an acoustic stillness, but a bodily stillness. They'll pick up on your breath and withdraw into their shell if they feel you coming. They think you're going to chew them up and eat them.
Well, and I was fascinated by the description of the moth, partly because you talked about its tongue unfurling. Now, I have to confess I'd never thought about a moth having a tongue. And the image that came to mind was from that game that kids play, Cooties. You put the arms and legs on to the body, and there is a little thing that looks like a tongue uncurling. And I'd always thought that was just a little plastic bit of fun that they were having. But it sounds as though if you're quiet enough, you can actually see something that most of us don't.
Yeah, all butterflies and moths have a proboscis that's curled up like a little one of those party favors. You blow into the end and it unfurls the little honking thing. The paper snake unwraps and blows out.
Exactly.
So they have this curled under their head. And this particular moth was harvesting sodium from the little lines in between my fingerprint. And it uses that in its breeding display and a breeding gift to the female. But you can observe this on flowers as well. If a swallowtail butterfly lands on a flower in a backyard, you can watch it unfurl its little tongue and sink it in there down into the nectar buried at the bottom of the flower. I think butterflies and moths, are actually compared to most insects, are a little more tolerant of humans being around them. And particularly those that are driven by this hunger for sodium sometimes can be quite hard to dislodge. The moth that I observed in the forest, even after a while, I tried to poke it with a pencil to get it to fly away, and it would not give up. It wanted my sodium.
And that's, of course, an entirely different kind of detail than from, twigs or lichens, for instance. You wrote pages about twigs. Most of us would pass over twigs in a second.
Exactly. Twigs, well, my shtick on twigs is that is our future written out. Twigs are the proximate place where all the carbon gets taken out of the atmosphere, or much of the carbon gets taken out of the atmosphere into biomass. And so by studying the lengthening of an obscure thing like a twig, we can read into our future, because the amount of growth on those twigs determines how much carbon is being sucked out of the atmosphere, and thereby how much the world is going to get, the world's climate is going to get destabilized. So these big global issues, climate change, biodiversity conservation, even human health and the new medicines we need to discover from nature, all those are grand, big questions. But the solution to those questions is going to be worked out in the details, in the tiny little particularities of natural history, how a twig grows, how a snail gathers calcium into its back that will feed a mother bird to get the calcium for her eggshells and so forth. Mm. So I think by focusing on the details, we can see out into these bigger questions. And that's my personal preference, is to focus on the particularities of the individual organisms, and then through that, to see the bigger questions, rather than starting at the big issue and saying, well, we need to do something about this. Let's try and get local about these questions. For me, as a human with a limited range of ability to grasp the whole world, starting out where I am and working out from there has been a more helpful way to understand.
E.O. Wilson says of your book that it's an example of a new kind of nature writing, somewhere located between science and poetry. What does it mean to try to bring those two modes of perception together?
I was honored that he said such kind things about my work. For me, science and poetry are not different things. Science is an application of the poet's desire to see the world and to revel in that world. And what I wanted to try to do in this book was not just to tell the stories of the forest, but to sing them, to take seriously the beauty of language, and to pay attention to how each sentence rolls, how the essay starts and ends, and just to hold up some juicy words and polish them up like jewels. So if I've succeeded in that a little bit, I'll be absolutely delighted. I do think that there is a very strong parallel between the written word and how forest ecosystems work. Ecosystems are all built on relationships. For me, the miracle of the written word, it's one of life's most amazing inventions, is that it connects our consciousnesses up. So when you read something I've written, when I read something someone else has written, the deepest part of ourselves, the center of our consciousness, is connected to another person's consciousness, and thereby we grow and change. And to me, that's a very ecological process. So walking into a bookstore is like walking into a forest. You can hear all these voices coming from different sides, all interacting in complicated and unpredictable ways.
I can see how a scientist reading poetry might change the way you do your science, I guess. It's as though if you can see poetic connections, it might lead you to scientific connections.
Absolutely, and I think all the best scientists have realized that. And whether they regard themselves as poets or read much poetry, is beside the point. The key is to see beyond the surface, and that's what poetry does, and that's what science does. It pushes us beyond just the superficial appearance of things, dive down into the meaning underneath patterns that we see either in the world or in language.
Of course, you did things in the course of this year of watching this square meter of land that I suspect are not taught in science classes, and I'm not sure it's poetic either. There was a day when you saw a bird. It was 20 below zero, and the bird was shivering, and I got the impression you decided that you would see what that felt like, so you pulled off all your clothes. 20 below zero, that's a crazy thing to do.
Well, you could look at that as an artistic installation in the woods. It was a very short-lived one. Yeah, my desire was to experience the world as these animals experienced it, unmediated by clothes or other technological aids in the forest. So it was the coldest day of the year. It was a very cold wind chill coming through. So I just stripped off in the woods and lasted about a minute. And then I was shivering so bad, and in fact, it wasn't just a physiological reaction, it was a psychological reaction. I was deeply alarmed by what was happening to my body. And so I tried to dress as quickly as I could. My hands were so numb I could barely hold the clothes or hold the zippers. Mm-hmm. The point there is to understand these things in my body, to overcome the sensory and imaginative limitations of me in the woods. And then to look at the little chickadee that was dancing in the trees above me with new eyes. That is just amazing, that this little bird that weighs just as much as 3 pennies can live through this cold day after day after day with no supermarket, no furnace in the home, and so on. And I can last a minute. How do they do that? And so then I sort of, in the essay, I look into the various ways in which their eyesight and their physiology is tuned to the world in ways that mine isn't. And I'm ultimately a tropical primate out of place in this cold northern world.
Well, it really brought to life for me the energy involved in what the chickadee needs in order to survive. Something, what did you say, 65,000 joules to last?
They need a phenomenal amount of energy intake each day. And each little insect or spider egg that they can find is just a tiny fraction of that. So that's why when you walk in the woods, the little chickadees are always active. They are on the edge of survival. And in fact, many of them, up to half of them, don't make it through the winter because they haven't managed to find enough insects. That's also why they like bird feeders, because a big, fat, oily sunflower seed is just an amazing gift. And it saved them having to find hundreds of little food items in the woods. So we bribe them in. We bribe these little gray flames into our lives with our bird feeders.
This whole year of observation must have been a humbling experience like that in some ways, wasn't it? I mean, your 1 square meter of forest had so many things you didn't know. You must have thought you did when you went in.
Like all humbling experiences, yeah, you wind up knowing the extent of your limitations. One of the limitations was the extent of my knowledge. I had a strong sense at the end of this year that I had just scratched the surface, and there were thousands of creatures here that I would never be able to know or name because nobody has ever studied them, and let alone know or name them, but understand how they all interact in the great drama of life. So that was part of the limitation, was a limitation of knowledge. The other was a limitation of my being able to even imagine how these other lives were playing out. For example, for birds, birds see an extra color that we don't have. So we have four primary colors. We have three. They have four. So they have colors that aren't even in the possibility of us being able to place in our minds. And so here I am living in basically a different world, a different sensory world than these creatures, and yet somehow we're all tied in this physical universe together. So that's an interesting tension to me, is the separation and the unity that we see in nature.
Did you, in looking at your 1 square meter, find things you'd never seen before? I don't mean never understood before, but I mean literally never seen before.
There were a number, particularly in the springtime, there were a number of interactions that I had never seen, and a number of species that, although I may have seen on the periphery of my vision, I'd never paid any attention to. For example, the dozens of species of flies and bees that emerged just during that brief springtime flush of wildflowers on the forest floor. They conduct their lives over just a few weeks before the tree canopy closes out, and then they shut down and go into it's not hibernation, but a period of quiescence, waiting for the next year to roll around. I am trained as a zoologist, and so part of what I got from this year in the woods was an appreciation of the extraordinary intricacies of botany as well. I identified dozens of plants that I'd never fully known about before.
You talk about how fascinating it was to be a human in that natural environment. A lot of people that care about nature, about the natural world, as you do in many ways, seem to think that humans are a problem. Do you? Are we the species that's spoiling the planet?
I think we belong in this world. And so we're part of it. And I think one of the things I'm a little uncomfortable with in some environmental rhetoric and writing is a misanthropic streak where it's humans are viewed as a big problem and as nasty things, as stains imposed on nature. I think if we take Darwin seriously, we have to realize that we are members of this community of life. There is no division between us and them. That means I think that we should extend our empathy out to the rest of the world. The flesh and nerves of other creatures are similar to and in some ways united to our flesh and nerves. But likewise, we need to turn the empathy inward. The Darwinian view of life teaches us that we belong here, that our less admirable behaviors, our greed and short-sightedness, can be understood through an evolutionary lens. We've got Stone Age desires and emotions in place in a world where we can have access to bulldozers and nuclear weapons. That doesn't excuse our behavior, but it does, I think, call for a more gentle approach to ourselves, an empathetic approach that isn't self-hating. And in a couple of chapters in the book, I try and develop those ideas of this Darwinian sense of empathy, an inward empathy for our own condition as evolved humans, and an outward sense of empathy to kinship, that when I look at a tree or a snail, that's my cousin. When I go to nature, I'm visiting with family, literally. We trace our ancestry back, and we come to the same family, the same little cell that split into two lineages many billions of years ago. One lineage led to me and one led to that oak tree. To me, that's a remarkable thing. And it sort of expands my mind out and realizes that this is one big family we're in.
Thank you.
It's been a delight.